song of freedom. Can't keep us down no more. Go sing a song.
This is the Reverend James M. Lawson, Jr., Emeritus Pastor of Holman United Methodist Church on KPFK for 2 o'clock conversation around the topic, Building a Powerful Left. And joining me for this conversation is Tom Hayden, a man who I have known since 1960, a friend and colleague. I've considered him a friend and colleague in the struggle for truth and justice. And I have, from a distance, oftentimes admired his continuing witness and leadership. When he was an elected official, I counted him as among one of the few elected officials who had the welfare of all the people of the United States in his mind and in his intellect as well. So, Tom, I'm glad to welcome you to our conversation.
Good afternoon, Reverend.
Same here.
50 years indeed.
That's right. It has been 1960.
I think you were slightly ahead of me.
Well, that's true. I was older than you by about 9 years.
I admire you having gone through the 50s. I thought of myself as simply a beneficiary of the spontaneous movements of the 60s. I was just moseying along trying to become a journalist when it all happened around me.
I understand that, but you were one of the few who reached out for the sit-in campaign in 1960 and reached out to SNCC as president, I think, at that time of the National Student Association and something else, University of Michigan, is that right?
I was actually a student editor at the University of Michigan, and
okay. The
National Student Association was supportive of the the sit-ins.
And you were one of the major people who...
And I was one of the student leaders who broke away, and we formed Students for a Democratic Society.
Okay.
It's a small point, but...
It's a good point.
Yeah.
Any central point. Yeah. Very good.
And SNCC, the students in the South, were, I think, the triggering force for the whole student movement across the country.
No 10 ways about it. I think that's right. And I would concur in a very real way with that. The generation of the 60s was called a silent generation. The student generation was called a silent generation. But as David Halberstam pointed out in both books and conversations, they were not silent. They were just waiting to see what the issues were, waiting to be challenged. And
let me ask you something, Jim Lawson.
Yeah.
Because you were there in the so-called silent period of the 50s, which really wasn't so silent when you consider Montgomery bus boycott.
Of course, that's
right. But there had been, to my understanding, attempts at sit-ins and freedom rides from the 40s on with little known effect, and yet here came a time on February 1st, 1961, when four students decided to sit in at a lunch counter, and soon 50 or 70,000 were in jail. What do you think it is that makes these social movements happen, or is it a kind of invisible hand? What is it?
Well, I point to an earlier moment than 1960, Tom, because... Number one, I had been hoping and working for nonviolent direct action in the United States within the black community since 1948 or 49. Secondly, you get the Montgomery bus boycott. There were other boycotts ahead of that, like Baton Rouge bus boycott.
Right.
And then Tallahassee, Florida. There was often long conversations about the bus situation and the indignity. But Montgomery was different because you had women especially, but a number of other people, Ed Nixon of the NAACP in Montgomery, who for 2 to 5 years had been talking back to the bus company on their abject abuse of black people who were the major customers on the bus. And when Rosa Parks refused to get up out of the seat for a white man in the bus, those people, Mary Jo Robinson, Ed Nixon, Rosa Parks, a number of other people, began to agitate. No, they didn't begin to agitate. They immediately called for a bus boycott for Monday, the 5th of December. And they called King and Ralph Abernathy and a number of other pastors. They put that message into the churches over the weekend. On Monday afternoon, they had a meeting of about 100 or so civic, fraternal, business, clergy, leadership of Montgomery. That group of 100 or so said, let's have an organization to do this bus boycott. Let's keep it going. Then they elected officers, and they nominated Martin Luther King Jr. for president. So he represented some 40 or 50,000 people who were fed up at a local level with an issue and were determined they wanted finally to change that situation. And he had the tools and the gifts and the intellect to begin to frame the issues in such a fashion as to not only maintain their unity in Montgomery itself, but to in turn lodge the notion that nonviolent direct action was critical. So what I maintain is that in contradiction to some of the way in which the academics have seen that student movement, when we recruited students in Nashville in 1959 to begin the desegregation of downtown Nashville, that was a deliberate recognition that always social action, revolutionary action, requires the presence and the input of the young, even though I was only 30 at the time.
That's right. You
so
were
you have no.
You
we've had
advisor.
A massive musical revolution of music in the 1960s and 70s and beyond. Well, notice almost inevitably that is engendered and motivated and pushed and lived by the young. Almost every revolutionary movement in the world, in the human race, has had to have the infusion or the initiation and agitation of the young. So I maintain we were joining in the student movement, the development of SNCC, we were joining an emerging direct action movement.
What's the lesson that you draw, though, for people today who say, listening to these programs on KPFK, where's the movement today? How can we recreate anything like that? It just seems too difficult. Do you just keep plugging away?
No, I think that question leads us into building a powerful left. And I think the first point I wanted to make about that was that the left, if I can use that term, though I don't like left-right, I think those are 19th century European constructions that may not be that accurate for our understanding our own experience in the United States, especially the experience of 250 years of slavery, especially the experience of women in the United States, especially the experience of our having destroyed an indigenous people, their religion, their culture, their languages, their dance, their music, over a 200-year period, and relegated them to a structural impoverishment and to a structural poverty like as perhaps never before in human history. I think we have to learn from that experience. I think, therefore, the left-right doesn't do anything for me.
Alan Minsky?
Yeah, I think the first issue is that people who think they know that we need a better society, people who think they can be improved and that our social, political, economic environment where they live can be improved, they need to identify themselves locally with a different set of people, a different set of issues, and help to direct the activism that is present in the United States, more formidable than perhaps it has ever been. Help direct the activism into concrete issues in the local community that will give experience locally, but also then hit the spark that can become a regional and a national movement. That's what I've learned from nonviolence, from Gandhi, and from my participation in the struggles of the 50s and 60s.
So you think it's unpredictable, but it's kind of like a spark that gets lit through direct action.
Absolutely. I think that was
trial and error and failure, right? Failure.
Exactly.
Failure.
Exactly.
Failure, and then something happens. This is
a
pattern, but I think it's very hard to convince people.
Because in many ways, too many of us who want change are quite comfortable where we are, and we do not want to make the commitments and the sacrifices or to make things for ourselves inconvenient. That is the necessity, that is a necessary consequence of developing movement. I don't know if I've said that well.
No, it may be so. I think often movements come from people that who are already restless and not particularly comfortable, but it requires organizers, and organizers have to almost develop a mission that doesn't exist in the ordinary job categories, and therefore they burn out or there's no economic stability. But I would say movement building is a lifestyle, and it requires urgency, but the urgency has got to be premised on a very long view. I feel totally urgent about Afghanistan, but I know it's not going to fall tomorrow. I just...
All right, but see, that's another point I want to make.
Go ahead.
We do not have a powerful left in the United States because the powerful left allows the power structures of the United States to shape what the critical issues are. I say it another way. Afghanistan and Iraq are not the primary issues facing 310 million people who live in these United States. It is colonialism and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House that see Iraq and Afghanistan as critical to the well-being of the American people. So we need to change our agenda away from following the power elite's analysis of ourselves and formulate our own agenda based upon, let me say, if I may, based upon, let's say, two things. One, maybe the platform of the preamble of the Constitution and the platform of the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, and then on human anguish and human need and human hurt in the United States. Not on the empire builders of the United States who have been around for a long time. So in my judgment, those of us who are critics of Afghanistan need to change our supporting the Council on Foreign Relations by agreeing with them that the Middle East is the critical issue in the United States. It is not. Iran is not our primary problem in relationship to nuclear proliferation. The United States is our major problem. Israel is our major problem. France,
well,
Great Britain, huh?
I think we're having a misunderstanding here.
Okay.
All my life, I have tried to work on local issues and expanding democracy, rights, student rights, and so forth.
Yes,
in the United
I agree.
States.
You have.
But every year, every three yeah. years, there's a new war. And the wars divert our attention,
absolutely.
Drain our resources,
kill absolutely.
A lot of people.
That's right.
And, you know, Iraq yes. alone, which nobody thinks about anymore, has already gonna, it's already going to cost us $3 trillion that is not there for housing, for health care, for
absolutely.
Environmental reform,
mm-hmm.
and so
that's
on.
Right.
So I see the necessity to stop these military expansions and occupations in order to focus our resources and attention back here at home. I used to think I'm going to work on what's in front of me here in Culver City or wherever I'm living, Atlanta, Georgia, and the wars were like faraway diversions. Now I just see them as daily obstacles. So I'm coming back to where you're coming from, but I don't see how we build a domestic movement without looking at the, and I'm sure you don't, looking at the military budget and these trillions of dollars for Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and so on.
I am the Reverend Jim Lawson on KPFK in a conversation with Tom Hayden. I agree with you about much of that, Tom, actually, but I think I'm trying to say something different. Especially the white so-called progressive movements have not identified themselves, let's say in Los Angeles, with organizing to eradicate hunger and homelessness, or organizing to stop police brutality, or organizing to demand with poor workers in Los Angeles their right to have a democratic union representing themselves in hotels, security positions, healthcare positions, so forth and so on. We have tended, the white progressive movements in Los Angeles have tended to stay aloof from these issues. And when a few people like a Rabbi Leonard Bierman or I or a Maria Elena DeRosso have identified in the streets with the working poor demanding their organization and their right to collectively bargain and to speak in one voice with the monolithic hotel chains that they work for, the progressive communities in Los Angeles, whether in Hollywood or in the Democratic Party or elsewhere, have remained aloof. They have not been willing to mix it up around that kind of issue of the human need and or the pain of a specific population in the city of Los Angeles. Now that's what I'm talking about when I say that if the left wants a powerful movement, then I think they have to change their agenda. They have to stop agreeing with the Pentagon and with the State Department over what are the critical issues in the world, and they have to be willing to blend their strength, and this is very hard to do, with the working poor or with black people or with sexism in Los Angeles, and here wrestle short-term and long-term to reverse these conditions. And in doing that, we will build a movement, I maintain, that will be a better peace movement, a better justice movement on the military issues than the peace movement has done for the last 30, 40 years. Remember that one of the most important, significant advances for struggle in the United States was done when Dr. King, my good friend and colleague, who I taught about nonviolent strategy and theory and the rest of it, and who we conferred over the Vietnam issue constantly as to when was the time for him to speak up, rather than speaking up as I was doing or being in peace marches as I was doing in 64, 65. And as he was doing in staff meetings, I insisted he had to make the decision for himself. But when once he made the decision that there could be a challenging of the Vietnam policies based on our struggle to dismantle Jim Crow law and racism in the United States, that sent a nuclear-like energy across the earth for people of hope. It created a new scene in the United States for the peace movement, for the Poor People's Campaign, and the rest. And the powers that be recognized that the only way to begin to halt that direction was to assassinate King, Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and a number of other people. That's why those assassinations of the 60s took place, because of the joining of the issues of making the domestic scene the priority issue, with the critique that meant of Vietnam. And in that speech, April 4, 1967, King made a critique that is still valid today of American foreign policy, also of those of us who struggle for peace and justice, because he said that unless we can manage to put in place in the United States a moral, political, social, spiritual revolution that would change the way America thinks, and he meant by that the State Department, the Council of Foreign Relations, big business, plantation capitalism, as I tend to call it, they have to be changed, and they cannot be changed by our pushing over there. They have to be changed by our creating a different agenda here. Are you with me, Tom?
I hear you.
You hear me. Okay. Well, what I'd like to say is that the so-called left in the United States does not have an agenda for all Americans. Nor does the political party, nor does the Democratic Party or the Republican Party have an agenda that will fulfill the lives, help 300 million people fulfill their lives. We have structural poverty that the Democratic Party and Republican Party are willing to continue indefinitely. We have forms of racism, of sexism, domestic violence and war, grotesque economic inequities that the Republican Party and Democratic Party are willing to tolerate as essential for contemporary American life. None of that addresses the well-being of the American people. So the so-called left, it seems to me, has to develop a different agenda from the status quo politics, from plantation capitalism, from big guns, and from big money. And I think the way to do that is not, well, let me say it another way. I think the way to do that is for us to tackle the issues of economic justice and racism and gender inequity, bad housing, so forth and so on, here in the United States, until we can build enough weight in our local situations that the national agenda can emerge and we can force, and I use that term without violence, that we can forge a new political, social, economic cultural alliance in the United States, even if it means a whole new political party reconfiguration. Tom?
I'm here.
And?
Well, that's a very provocative and solid view, and it's certainly a view that I've taken at some points in my life.
I know you have.
As a community organizer and as a legislator working on California budget problems, school problems, prison problems, gang problems, police problems. And I don't think it's an either-or. I think there should be room in your analysis for a peace movement and an environmental movement that should be as grounded as possible in building up a local power base. I agree with that. But I do think, after these many years, that our kind of society is built on economic expansion abroad as a source of wealth and as a way to channel discontent into foreign wars and foreign adventures, and you could almost say it started with the Europeans who came here and formed colonies. Large numbers of them were channeled away from the English Civil War and Revolution because the lords and powers that be in Europe wanted to siphon off these unemployed laborers and so on, and turn them into Indian fighters and invaders of Ireland and,
Tom,
and this continent. So,
Tom, you and I need to find a time to continue this conversation. I want to thank you for being here on the conversation. I want to continue the conversation with you. I want to thank the Angela Jones, the engineer, and Candice Carnicelli, the producer. And we'll be back here at 2 o'clock next Friday. Thank you.